who don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 331, and we got to do Get It Done. It's the big starting the new year off, right? It's your host, Stevie Whiteyway, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. So, up first, back in cryo sleep in the stasis chamber, Christmas Zaddy has powered down until Christmas in July, but he is still our favorite critic. It is Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
Oh, well, yes, if the hibernation has begun in the post-Christmas sense, but still so many exciting new things to explore. Also, this is the time of year, I feel like, when people get to exchange the gifts they didn't want and, you know, get what they really were after. And I wanted to make a recommendation in that regard. And that would be this amazing book, Agnes Varda. It's part of the Director's Inspiration series that the Academy Museum, or the Academy proper, I guess, has been publishing. This one is edited by my dear friend Matt Severson, who is the head muckety-muck, I never remember his title, at the Margaret Herrick Library, which, if you live in Los Angeles, is an invaluable resource of movie information. I mean, they just have, they've got all the receipts. They've got all of the back issues of everything you ever needed. They've got all of the biographical information and the archives of posters and stills. And it's a great facility. But anyway, this Varda book is really extraordinary. I'm a huge fan of her, obviously, as a director. And this contains just some really extraordinary essays by wonderful people like Peter de Bruges, Manola Dargis from the New York Times, a lot of critics and scholars really reflecting on Varda's unique place in the cinematic universe. You know, she was really the major female director to emerge from the French New Wave. She really was spearheaded restoration in a time that people hadn't quite figured out yet that was a thing you had to do. And a filmmaker was just constantly reinventing herself over the course of her career. So, see her movies, of course, but also pick up this great book. It's an invaluable resource. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Ooh, so good.
Right on.
Look, such we love good books. Yeah. I think it's a solid time for that because, you know, a lot of people are going to have, you know, book lists and reading that they want to do for their resolution. So definitely hop on it. First book rec of the year, maybe. Speaking of well-read, you know, we have the queen of the Midwest herself, Super Festival programmer, producer, none other than Drea Clark. What is good?
I love that Alonzo brought in, like, this beautiful book about an esteemed filmmaker. And I'm going to tell you what I brought in was spearmint tea. And I stand by that. I have been, you guys know I love tea in many forms, and I've had mint teas recommended to me before, and in my head I was always, nah, that's gonna be some like nettles in water nonsense. That's some like of the people in the fields. I've been the people in the fields. I would like a bougier drink, but let me tell you, spearmint tea is that bougier drink. Spearmint tea with a little honey, it will change your life. I mean, I'm not gonna like guarantee that in a monetary way, but the option, the possibility is there. It really, it's delightful. It's caffeine free.
Well, look, Drea, for one thing, this doesn't always happen. Your good thing and my good thing could be enjoyed together.
Ooh, well, thank you, Alonzo.
So there's that. Also,
please cozy up with your Agnes Varda book.
Yes, and a nice steaming mug of spearmint tea. Also, I think the minty teas are really good when you're having the not great tummy. You know, they're very soothing, and I'm not a tea person, but I will put on my food is medicine hat and have that.
Yeah. Okay, I'll take that. You really just enriched my choice when I was just like, I like this thing when I drink it. I mean, I stand by that.
I'm here to yes and you.
I don't find guilt and pleasure, and that includes my mint tea.
Nor should you.
Yeah, feel free to sip. Never have any, you know, embarrassment.
Don't apologize for flavors.
Thanks, gang.
Sip
thanks
freely. Now, as you know, we have amazing guests on this podcast. Today is no different. This is someone who I assume sips freely. It is none other than film producer Allison Dickey. What's good?
Kicking off 24. Right.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this and I think it was Ify was talking about Vidiots, and I just have this crazy fact about that library that I'm not sure everybody knows, and it is such a good thing I have to say it. So all the streamers put together have about 10,000 titles, all of them put together. And Vidiot's library has 60,000. So, wow. You know, there's this horrible thing where you just can't find any films now. You just can't. There's like some actors who are huge and important in our film world. You literally can't see their films. So pop on over there and, you know, dig deep because you're going to find it. So that's a really good thing.
Like how movies used to say, when in Southern California, visit Universal Studios. Also, visit Vidiots.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
I can only yes and that. You know, also, like, historically, that's where folks were going to get, like, deep cut indies to check out back in the day. And, you know, I just rented out Maltese Falcon, two documentaries about Coffee, The Driver, and it's a Sonny Chiba horror film that I'm forgetting the name. It was like It Came from the Deep or something like that. So I, you know, those are things that you don't just like scroll across on Netflix or streamers because they're just pushing like the new hotness in
Peacock
front of you.
Peacock does not have a Sonny Chiba section last time I checked.
So. Yeah. So,
but wait, my other sort of good thing is, speaking of new hotness, there's a great article in New York Magazine which is titled His Red Carpet to Lose, which is all of Timothy Chalamet's red carpet looks, which I highly recommend you look up because it is incredibly entertaining, including the Heider Ackerman backless one and the Prada spacesuit one. It's very entertaining.
I mean, right now it sounds like Allison's a ringer for Ify here. She's bringing up
Vidiots
the Timmy.
And Timmy.
Oh, I didn't know.
I want to lay claim that Allison is my friend because she's going to say such great things, but it really sounds like she's here as an Ify Wadiway plant. Just like alley-ooping him left and right. Yeah.
Look, you know, we're just going, I'm excited to see post-Wonka Timmy. You know, everyone has followed since he stopped following people, but he still was responding to my DMs. Let's see if he will stop responding. That is my guess. That post-Wonka, he's like, all right, Ify, I'm a little too big for you. No, it doesn't matter that we did a short film together 10 years ago. I had a friend today ask me, it was like, when you were on the set of that short film, did you think he was going to blow up that big? And now it's reached a no, because I know he was going to be successful because he had that you know what I mean? When you're like, oh yeah, this kid gets it. He knows, he's like in it. He has a mode. But if you were to be, if you were like, this kid is the guy. So shout out to you, Timmy. I'm sure you're listening to every episode.
Yeah.
Never misses, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, he may not return your text, but he's definitely listening.
Look, I said DMs. DMs. Oh. I mean, his text message changed after his Oscar run. Like, I lost his number.
Well, apart from your deep and abiding friendship with Timothy Chalamet, Ify, what's good?
What is good with me? Well, you know, it's the beginning of the new year, and that means that we are just a couple weeks away from a bunch of things. You know, I can say, you know, Sundance or Slam Dance, something that I learned rival each other and happen at the same time. I didn't know that. I thought they were homies.
Do you know that I was the festival director at Slam Dance and that I ran programming there for 13 years?
Well, you've been doing both. You've been doing both, which I was like,
I went from Slam Dance to Sundance years ago.
She has literally worked both sides of the street in Park City.
Yeah. That is that. Look, that is a beef I love, but the also what coincides and also like ruins of the life of a comedian filmmaker is also San Francisco Sketch Fest, which I am one of the Sketchfest dozen this year, honored as one of the comedians. So on the 19th, I'm giving you well enough time. Usually I give you a week. I'm giving you well enough time. It's the 5th on January 19th, if you're in the San Francisco area. Me and Paige Weldon, who is also very funny, will be sharing a slot at 7 to 9:30 on the 19th. And then at 7, I'm doing Dimmy at Did You eBay's show. Everything's great. And at 9:30, the big team, we're going to do some stupid shit on stage. So it'll be great. It's a good weekend of comedy. And somewhere between that and now, I'm going to make it out to Sundance because my friend Allison had me in her short, Pathological, that has been honored. And so I'm going to try and be out there to see it. And I've hit up all my Sketchfest pros about best practices. And I'm already failing because I still haven't found a room and board. And it's only going to get harder from here.
I'm going to connect you with a board about that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you, Drea.
Maybe stop asking comedians.
We're known for always having the best ways of crashing on dirty floors.
I communicate almost entirely in spreadsheets, and you ask them.
I was going to say, ask a woman who has an Excel fetish. She will steer you right.
He's not wrong. Yeah.
All right. Well, today we're considering the zone of interest, and later we'll have a movie quiz about Next Door Neighbors. But first, this is our first episode of the new year, and that means it's time for us to make some resolutions for the new movie year ahead. This is our time to name what we're looking forward to, what we're hoping for in the world of movies and the film industry of 2024, or maybe we've got some personal movie-related goals for the year ahead. It feels like Marissa wrote that specifically for me because she knew I was going to shoehorn it in anyway. So who wants to start?
Well, I want to make a resolution for someone else. Namely, I would love for lawmakers to step in and prevent companies from shelving movies and TV shows for eternity as a tax write-off, because that just seems like it should be illegal somehow. That just seems like you are wasting a lot of people's time and money and then, denying the world their creation. And we've talked about this a bunch on the show, but it just, every time this comes up, it still makes me mad. So yeah, I want to see like some actual, because we know that business is never going to regulate itself. So I am very in favor of the boot of big government standing on the neck of specifically David Zaslav.
jail to mother. Yes, I agree. That is a fantastic place to start. Regulation in the arts, not always my favorite two things to put next to each other. However, watching this increasing pattern and then just the idea of wrapping my little brain around a $50 million tax write-off that is somehow more beneficial than work that has been produced, like Alonzo said, by hundreds and hundreds of people, many of whom leave their families for a long amount of time to be able to work on it, put their heart and experience and blood, sweat, and tears into it, and just the ugliness. I'll piggyback on that. It was part of a lot of the strike talks. And I feel like 2024 is the year where we're going to see some sort of more culturally recognizable impact of AI. And I would like that. My resolution dream is that when we see that, it is a turning point for also some sort of deeper protections beyond the unions of what AI in the creation process means to the creators in our industry. And I say our industry by every industry. That's my thing. I would like to see the reins on what that is come into sharper. How do reins work? It's been a while since I've been on a horse, gang. But trust me, when there needs to be reins involved, I feel confident with that part of it.
All right. Mine is just, we got to get back. We just got to get back into theaters. We have to engage each other, and we have to think of some, from a marketing standpoint, some more creative ways with getting filmmakers in the theaters for Q&As and trying to make events out of screenings, and you know, I love when Alamo Drafthouse does interactive screenings, and you know, the Stop Making Sense films have turned into dance parties in the theaters, and just to try to get really creative about getting people back out into the theater. And you know, that goes for myself included. You know, you sort of get used to not going, and then when you go, you realize like, oh no, this is the only way to see these films.
And they're looking at, I mean, this is obviously on the more sort of bummer projection, but like a $2 billion drop off in box office next year because of the strikes and the residual impact of that. And so I'm totally with you. Like, bring out more retrospective anniversary screenings. Like, Disney just did, aren't they re-releasing in theaters a bunch of things that
Soul, Luca, which I'm really glad because
Turning Red, because they never played theater before.
Yes, because things that got sort of squandered in the pandemic days. And I'd add to that, both on the in theater side and also the streaming side, please dip into the indie world to supplement what is coming out and actually be giving marketing and promotions and uplifting. Like, there's so many movies at this point that go straight to streaming, which would be fine. I'd love to be on Netflix. Can you please also tell people how to easily find me on Netflix and that I'm there?
That I exist, yes.
Yeah, and that's something like we started this year talking about Rye Lane, which was a beautiful film out of Sundance that Searchlight picked up that went right to Hulu. The amount of people that would find that charming and wonderful has even the smallest percent of them seen it. So yeah, if they're all like twitchy ass as they should be about projected box office, then do what you can to actually like support the films and broaden what films those are.
Yeah, I think on the other end too, I hope that, you know, we get to this point, because I think something that the strikes have taught us and that we've seen is just like the over, like, you know, consumerizing and business getting into art has led to this like dependency on that Marvel model, that I'll just say. Specifically, you know, there was a thing today that it was, they were saying like, oh, they're considering doing an Uncle Fester series to make a Wednesday universe. And someone retweeted like, everything that's successful doesn't have to be a universe. But because of the way that we've started making films, where it's like we're trying to make them billion-dollar industries so that we can make these shareholders happy, it has kind of put in a stop to it. I was at a, you know, writer meetup, and everyone's talking about every meeting you go to, they're throwing a book of IPs at you because they want to make, I like, there's just this bubble that I'm hoping that is going to start to burst, because I think as we've seen year and year again, always the standout are the new original ideas. And I think that we can have a world where you can carve out the Marvels of the world when they come naturally, but we can also have a world where we support and put up, you know, these amazing, just like original ideas and these stories that are being told that don't need to be fleshed out so that you can make $1 billion.
As we've always said, could we please not learn all the wrong lessons from the success of Barbie?
Yes.
Because there are some right ones to learn.
Oh yeah. So go ahead and watch this space to see how those resolutions unfold over the year. And if you have a 2024 movie resolution, go ahead and share them on our Facebook group. That's at facebook.com/groups/maximumfilm. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're talking about the zone of interest.
The following are real reenactments of pretend emergency calls.
911.
My husband! It's my husband!
Calm down, please. What about your husband?
He loads the dishwasher wrong. Please help! Please help me!
Where are you now, ma'am?
At the kitchen table. I was with my dad. He mispronounces words intentionally.
There are plenty of podcasts on the hunt for justice, but only one podcast has the courage to take on the silly crimes. Judge John Hodgman, the only true crime podcast that won't leave you feeling sad and bad and scared for once. Only on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Vivi Wadiway. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Allison Dickey.
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today's movie comes from director Jonathan Glazer. We've already told you that the Los Angeles Film Critics Association named it the best film of the year. It premiered at Cannes, where it won the Grand Prix, and is loosely based on a novel by Martin Amis. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of The Zone of Interest?
Meet the Huss family. They're just, you know, trying to make their way through this crazy world. Oh, did I mention he's a Nazi commandant? And their beautiful house is on the other side of the fence from Auschwitz. And it sort of literally and figuratively looms over everything that happens in this movie. And they seem not to be bothered by that. And it's as horrifying as it sounds in that context. Zone of Interest.
It is a rough one to describe.
Yeah, you did it.
Yeah. I'm going to kick this off with Marissa's discussion prompt. I say this often because I often do it. But because I think it is an interesting start, which was before seeing this film, how would you have answered the question, do we need another World War II movie? And, you know, it's so funny because I feel like there was a world before where you're like, yeah, I don't know. And I think in the recent time and years, you're like, yeah, no, I think people need reminders. And I think that, you know, I was thinking about while watching it, because, you know, I often think about how the general public feels about any type of, you know, horrific event kind of being played out on the screen, and how, you know, if it's a rehash and if it's necessary. And I think it's this movie was so necessary for two reasons. The first reason being, this is such a fresh take and way to look at it. It's artful in what it's trying to do. And two, I think it's more necessary and so relevant in today's, you know, climate than anything, because it is speaking not only to, you know, a very, you know, horrific event, but to a attitude that I think still happens with folks in this day, and how you can, yeah, you know, we'll get into it as we talk about it more, but that's just my opening thing. But I also wanted to open the question to everything else and didn't want to hog it up.
We have such an ongoing thing in programming at festivals. There are a lot of films made that circle the Holocaust that are either centered on a particular family experience, centered on it in a historical context. And
the
so
aftermath.
It is. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Yeah, that it is a real touchstone to be looking at any film, narrative or documentary, and asking that question of, is this an additional exploration that is needed beyond what this artist needed to expect? Like, what can, or express, excuse me, what can an audience glean from this? And what Iffy's getting at, and what makes this incredibly special, even beyond, like, there's some really masterful technical components of this film. But this movie is about the sort of cross-section of complacency and complicity, and watching it play out in this domestic setting. And like Alonzo said, it is a very hard watch in so many ways, when it is also, if you are somehow beautifully clueless about what is happening, you won't be. I mean, it's right there, but there is a way of watching this movie like, huh, are they next to a factory? Like, there's things that you could do that's just like, oh, this is a family going through motions. This is a movie that so much weight of it is subtext, and what that allows different audiences to do in terms of experiencing this or seeing it, or if he said, like, the providing of a different perspective on something that we have seen represented in film before. Yeah, I was told it was coming, and it still took me by surprise.
You know, I always think when we talk about, you know, movies that are about, you know, the history of racism in this country, for example, or movies about the Holocaust, it's very simple for a filmmaker to show you, oh, look at this monster. Isn't this monster monstrous? Mm. We're not that. This person is somehow unique and different and monstrous. And this movie is about, no, human beings designed all this, human beings made all this happen, and human beings went on with their business and, you know, made a nice little lawn for themselves and, you know, sent the kids off to school and made breakfast while this shit was happening, and they were fully aware this was happening. And so so many movies, I think, are let us off the hook. You know, you watch The Help and you think, oh, well, I would be like that nice Emma Stone. I wouldn't be like that mean lady who didn't like black people. And this movie doesn't give you that out. This movie makes you have to think about what awful things am I ignoring as I go through my day to day? Who is suffering to make me comfortable right now? You know, this movie demands a lot of its audience and makes you ask questions, not just about history, but about the present and yourself, that I think many movies just won't touch.
Well, I really agree with that, Alonso. And that's one of the really the main reasons why I think this is a really important and beautiful film. I think the sort of intimate look at a human's ability to compartmentalize is just fascinating and absolutely heartbreaking. And I think the one thing he took from the Martin Amis novel was focusing on the, you know, the point of view of a perpetrator. But what he does, Jonathan Glazer does, which I think is really, really interesting, is he throws us into the daily rhythms of family life. So we recognize that. We recognize the chaos of a busy household with kids, and we recognize the routine and the sort of normalness of, you know, raising a family. But the sounds of the business next door and the smoke in the sky makes you realize that there's this sort of evil energy that is infiltrating this family, and you start to see these little cracks and fissures, and it's fascinating how that unfolds. You know, it's really, really very masterfully done, I thought.
It's, again, it's hard to explain because everything we're saying is horrific, and it is, but it is not there are a lot of films that are so much more surface dark, and this is so much about, oh, what are we seeing these people ignore, like you're saying? And the idea of those glimpses we get of them, and then, you know, the sort of next huge talking point of this, like I was saying, the technical creation of what is leading us to it. Like, this is a movie you can soak into the story and soak into the perspective and the POV, but how it was set up to give us that is so gorgeously done. Like, there's so many beautiful articles right now about how they set up cameras almost like reality TV style. Mm-hmm. They would often have like more than one scene. Jonathan Glazer obviously is the director and was overseeing this, and would have people performing scenes at different times in different rooms, and they weren't really sure which ones were kind of the key moment at that time, or, you know, everything you're looking at of where the camera is. And then obviously, like, the sound design in this.
Yes, Johnny Byrne.
I think there's a really beautiful thing that happens in certain films where you're given the key in the first couple of minutes of a movie of how you're meant to watch it. And so this movie, you know, starts with almost 3 minutes of black with just Mike Levy's score. And to the point where, you know, if you were home watching it, you'd be like making sure your TV is still working. It's like almost 3 minutes. And then you hear very, very softly some birds chirping. And it really gives you the language and the key of how you're meant to be watching this film. You know, you're going to be listening, and your body has to rearrange itself and really settle in. And then, you know, I think you're really able to receive the movie in the way that he wants you to. It's like very smart decisions like that, I think, are really compelling.
Yeah. LA Film Critics honored Mika Levy with the music score award this year, but then also made a special commendation for Johnny Byrne for the sound design, because, yeah, like it's like Dre was saying, if you took that out, it's another movie. Like there's an edit somewhere where basically this is just a sort of like domestic drama, you know.
This
like
is Anatomy of a Fall. Yeah.
Yeah. Which also, both of which feature Sandra Hüller. And yeah, and interestingly, I think there is a level of both movies that where it's about, I mean, yes, it's about a horrific event. And at the same time, it's also about just a marriage and the things that people work around and don't talk about and try and slide over and you know, won't address, basically, and obviously against a backdrop of a much larger issue. But that strain is very much present in both films.
You know, he made an interesting comment, Jonathan Glazer, that he wasn't he read a lot about the ethics of representation, and he didn't want to get into the recreation of an atrocity. But in some very clever ways, he was able to really highlight the horror of it in another way, because you're watching a kid, you think he's reading under the covers, and you discover that he's playing with teeth. Or the visiting mother wakes up from a nap and starts and coughing, and then just leaves in the dark of night because she just sees and understands what's going on and can't.
There's that strain of horror, I think, that's so effective, yeah, where it's all about what you don't see, mm-hmm, what's implied. You know, Robert Wise's The Haunting, I think, is sort of maybe the apex of that. But this movie knows what we know about, you know, the granular nature of the mechanics of Auschwitz, and they don't have to show it to us. They can just, mm-hmm, give us those little moments. They can give us that sound design. When we hear the train, we know what's happening and why that train is there and who's on it and what's going to happen to those people, you know. And so it is that thing of, like, I don't have to show you the murderer. I just have to show you the outline of things or the sound of the person coming in the room. Like, it is a horror movie technique to address a historical horror.
Exactly. And I think can be very effective, and almost more effective in some ways.
You know? Absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
100%. I think that is the beauty of this movie, is how purposefully boring it is at times, where it's, you're just kind of watching a family. And I definitely mean, like, boring in a good sense. I'm not saying that I was bored. I mean that it had to be specifically very mundane, while you just get those hints of, like, gunshots in the background, yelling, noise. And it's almost, you know, where you'll have these very silent scenes and very unexplained things. I think one of my favorite moments is when they're having the argument by the water. And she's begging to stay at this house because it's the life that they built. And meanwhile, this house is right outside of this horrible place, and she's begging for it. But then they pan out and you see another pair of shoes there that are unexplained, and they kind of pick it up and walk away. And we, as the audience, knowing history, knows what those shoes meant and what it was. And to them in the scene, it is just like, oh, let's get rid of this. And it's like, just how much there was no care about what was actually being done and the distance from it. And, you know, we were talking about this before, right, about how it's necessary, because I do think that just in general, villains are always painted as these, like, very unfeeling, uncaring, unrelatable things. They're such an other. So it's very easy to never look in the mirror and wonder if you can potentially be a victim. Never wonder if you could be doing more. Never wonder if you're doing enough, because the way that villains are portrayed in movies is like, oh no, you have to, it is so intentional. It is so evil. It is so clear cut. And this movie does a perfect example of showing us what a real life villain can be, of knowing and choosing not to do anything to not inconvenience the life that you want.
Both of you, both Iffy and Alonso, have brought up that really purposeful idea of the willful obliviousness that's going on here, and the gains that person gets by being oblivious, and how you have to make a moral judgment call on yourself. And like Alonso said, it's a very powerful thought, just philosophically, above and beyond artistically, of what are you permissing in your world for the comfort that you have. And, you know, certainly we're at a place in time in history where we have seen that in unfolding in a lot of different ugly ways. Like, there are huge, complicated geopolitical things going on right now that are at the crux of that. And there's that alignment of, oh, do you quickly scroll by it? Do you feel rendered painfully impotent to not be able to do anything? Like, there's a whole lot. So seeing this demonstration of something in a historical context, like, oh, this happened so long ago, and yet it's still relatable and gives you like that avenue for what film can do for insights, for sort of personal prodding into action or just asking of questions, I think it's one of my favorite things. I'm someone who loves film for escapism, for shared experiences, for joy. But I also think, you know, all of what you can learn and embedder, definitely a word, definitely a real word, how you can embedder yourself and embiggen your own brain. But I think those things are as meaningful. And I say this because I don't think Jonathan Glazer was like, oh, I'd like to change the world's opinion on something. I think as an artist with personal ties and roots to this story, how do you navigate this? And the idea of reading the book that it's based on. And in the book, it's completely, I read a lot of Martin Amis. I'm a big fan of all the Amises, but the book, she is actually having an affair with another soldier at Auschwitz, like all of this stuff. He was simply looked at it of, oh, the placement of this home and everything that would have to be, that is fascinating.
That's a beautiful thing about filmmaking, is that it's when you're writing a novel, you can paint any picture of any location. You can switch point of view thousands of millions of times within your book if you want to. But when you're making a movie, it's a physical thing, and you go on a location scout and you are thinking you're going to make one movie, and you find this derelict house that's still sitting there, and you walk inside, and you, all of a sudden, you know, Jonathan Glazer was like, this is the movie. The entire movie is going to take place in this house. It's a beautiful thing about making a film, is there's sometimes it tackles you and tells you what to do just by physically walking through the paces.
I don't know why I thought this, but I thought that the Sandra Hüller character was going to be either ignorant of what was going on or knew but didn't want to address it and just sort of like, you know, lived in that sort of Tennessee Williams hazy, like, oh, I don't know. But no. She is very actively in on what's going on. There's a scene early on where she has Jewish staff, and she basically threatens if they don't make the bed right, she's going to send them to the other side of the wall. She is trying on a fur coat, and she knows where that fur coat came from. We know where that fur coat came from. And then to top it off, she finds a lipstick in the pocket and tries that on too. It's just like, it's so intimate and horrifying, and the whole thing made my skin crawl. And I Jonathan Glazer, this is his fourth feature. I think they're all amazing, they're all different. He achieves different ends, but like always through these means that are so, he loves the language of filmmaking and all the different ways you can get an audience to respond to things or to think about things. And so I don't know even how to compare this to Birth or Under the Skin or Sexy Beast, but I just know that he steers these ships in such a masterful way.
It's really interesting. You know, I wanted to just talk to you guys for a second about the end when he's walking out of that building, and after he's kind of boasting about promotion,
the productivity,
extracting the Jews from Hungary, and you know, they called it the Haas operation, and then he's leaving alone at night, and he stops to like dry heave in the stairwell, and I thought that was really interesting, and I wonder if in some way his body is betraying him, you know, like that he maybe there's some on some level. Does some part of him know that he's on the wrong side of history? There's this interesting historical side note, which is that after Haas was arrested in 1946, he wrote that my family had a good in Auschwitz. Every wish that my wife or children had was fulfilled, you know, remarking that his wife had her flower paradise. And then he was eventually hanged at Auschwitz in 1947, not far from that house. And so when you watch the film and you think about that as the true end to that life. It's really interesting.
It becomes another moral quandary, right? Of if the commandant, if the husband is having either his body is inkling or he is sort of brought up to his wife over the phone right before then of like, yeah, I just found myself at a party wondering how I could kill everyone at the party. And she's like, yeah, that's great. I'll see you when you get here. And for me, the idea of, oh, are we grading which one of them is worse? Like, he is literally directly responsible for all of these things. This woman is actively, I mean, they're both garbage. I'm not actually asking you to make that, but it is a really interesting division. Yeah, quandary. Thank you. It's mostly unrelated, but I did have a passing thought of how both this and Killers of the Flower Moon end with us in real life.
Yes.
And with us right in the places that are either directly, because we're, you know, this film ends with us watching now the day-to-day, the mundane actions of what it continues to happen now that it's this museum. And this testament to the loss and destruction. And in obviously Killers of the Flower Moon, which we discussed, we have Scorsese himself coming out and saying, like, this is what history looked like and this is storytelling. And I thought both of these, again, the catalyst of what are we asking viewers other than just please see the side of it. But then, you know, both of them have a sort of inward compulsion of...
I haven't quite wrestled this idea to the ground, but I was thinking that both of those endings that you mentioned, and then also Todd Haynes's May December, all kind of address in different ways the inability of art to capture something that is an unthinkable act. You know, the inability, like the limitations of narrative or drama or just, you know, any kind of representation of an act. And I'm not trying to equate like statutory rape with genocide, but they are all things that are outside the pale of regular human behavior. And all of these films kind of seem to come to this place of like, I'm doing my best here. I am trying to convey this, but even I acknowledge that there's only so far I can go with this as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, as an artist. And again, I haven't fully nailed down this idea, but all three of these movies kind of give me that same feeling of like, we're going to go here as far as we can, but don't leave the theater thinking like you've seen it or you've been there or you've really understood it. We've understood it as much as I can take you there, as much as any of us can begin to grasp these activities that just are not things that we should be doing.
Think peace. Think peace. Vote, 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 vote.
Yes, yes. The way we vote for things on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. Who would like to start?
I would. I'm definitely a screen it. And the reason that I want to just kind of hop in, because I think we're all going to say some variation of this, see this movie in a theater so that you can hear this movie in a theater. I think it really demands that level of participation, that level of interaction with the craft that is going on here. You can see it at home. You will have that opportunity at some point. And yes, Iffy and many other people out there have amazing sound systems, but I really think there is no comparison to the darkness combined with, you know, Mika Levy's score, Johnny Byrne's soundscape. It is an essential piece of this film, and I think that it really has to be experienced in that way. If at possible, if you are, you know, if it's showing near you, if you are comfortable going to movie theaters, all of the usual caveats apply. But if you can, please do.
I'll back that up. I'm also a screen it. I think this is some really special filmmaking. I'll also add, a lot of when we pitch films like this, it sounds like, oh, this is the vegetable kind of film. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the time of year when it's like, oh, this is good for you to see. Or maybe it's not like, oh, that doesn't sound so delicious, but I think there's so much to be gained. And it's not a film that I'll be like, oh, you'll have a great time, but I don't think you'll be miserable. I'm not pitching this well. Yes, go see it in a theater if you can, if you're lucky enough to, but do see it.
I'm a definite screen it. I mean, it is it is also, besides the sound design, so I echo everything that you guys just said about that, but there's, it's also visually really beautifully done. And he does some very compelling and interesting and sort of out of the box things visually with the film. So I think all of it together really, you know, gives you an experience, and it's thoughtful and hard, but it's important.
It's shot by Lucas Zal, who did Cold War and Ida, and I'm thinking of Ending Things, if that gives you any idea of palette we're working with here.
I am screen it. It is definitely a necessary film. What everyone said, you know, I was one who did watch it on a smaller screen and wish I saw it in a theater. I do think, like, you know, Allison was saying, that opening in darkness, I was sitting there like, did it, like, I'm hearing the music. Is it Frozen? Whereas, like, if you're in a theater, you're like, okay, everything is happening as intended. But yeah, extremely, these shots are so powerful. Just the color story, also extremely powerful. And yeah, you feel like a fly on the wall for some of the worst people. But, you know, oddly enough, you know, I think we're in this black and white way of ingesting art, and where we need, like, to know the bad people are bad and the good people are good. And I think, you know, some people might, you know, freak out at the idea of adding the level of humanity to these people. But please believe me when I say adding the humanity makes it worse, because the humanity is the thing that we believe is what allows us to not do these things, and to see that they still choose to, and not even, and because it is convenient, and because it makes their life better, you know, to think that where they live, and to hear her say this is the life they fought for and the dream home, it really kind of, I think that really nails everything you need to know about these people and this movie. On that note, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
This is Lori Kilmartin.
And I'm Jackie Cation. And we have a podcast called The Jackie and Lori Show on Max Fun. And it's very exciting because what do we talk about?
Comedy.
Stand-up comedy. We both do stand-up comedy and have since the dawn of Christ.
Well, Jackie.
Is that offensive?
It is offensive to me because you've aged me. we started in the late 80s and we're still here. You can't kill us.
So go to The Jackie and Lori Show on Max Fun and listen to that.
Jackie and Lori Show. New episodes Monday, only on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are
Alonso Duralde,
Allison Dickey,
Drea Clark,
and Marissa Flaxbart. Hello. Hi, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So we have a movie today where it's very significant to the plot that the protagonists live next door to something. Something terrible in this case. So I started to think, wouldn't it be fun? We haven't done a quiz in a while. We'll lighten the mood a little bit. We'll look for other movies where there is something interesting next door, and that's an important part of the story. And so what I'm going to do in today's quiz is I'm going to tell you, usually it'll be who. I couldn't find that many what's, unfortunately, but I'm going to tell you who lives next door, and you can tell me what the movie is, okay?
Okay. Allison, right. Don't worry. Alonso generally smokes us on this. No pressure.
And I do have, as a backup detail, the year that the movie was released, okay? But I think you guys are going to be able to get these. Okay.
I vote that we yell out, howdy neighbor, if we have an answer.
Ooh, we're buzzing in. Okay, howdy neighbor, sounds great. Okay. So in our first film, Who's Next Door? It's the site of the Manson murders.
Howdy neighbor.
Iffy.
Is this...
Come on, girl. Come on.
Tarantino's.
Yeah.
Yes.
Once upon a time,
yeah.
In LA, in Hollywood. Once upon a time in Hollywood.
Hey!
Once upon a time in Culver City.
Once upon a time in the hills. All
Once
right.
upon a time in Baldwin Hills. That's going to be the black version I do.
You got to find a murder that happened there, then go from there. Okay. This next one takes place next door to a nouveau riche billionaire on Long Island.
Oh, what neighbor? Howdy, neighbor. The Great Gatsby?
The Great Gatsby.
Oh, yeah.
As written by a Minnesota author, just saying.
This next one takes place next door to a songwriter, Miss Lonely Hearts, a couple with a dog, and it seems a murderer.
Howdy, neighbor.
Alonzo.
Rear Window.
Oh, job, okay. Miss Lonely Hearts.
This one had Alonzo written all over it, right?
I like that I couldn't even remember Howdy, neighbor. Hey, neighbor.
All right. Question four. Next door is an intense and nosy cop with an adorable white dog.
Oh, howdy, neighbor. Game night. Yes.
Game night.
Oh, nice. That can't be profitable for Frito-Lay.
Yeah.
Jesse Plemons. He's so star turn.
He's so good.
Should have won an Oscar for that.
All right. In this next one, surprise, a Satan-worshipping cult who's really excited about your newborn.
We'll go for it.
Allison, you take it.
Rosemary's Baby.
That's right.
Yeah, that was going to be okay. Ooh, that was my guess. Wasn't too far off.
All right, we have next door a budding young sociopath who likes to Frankenstein toys together.
Howdy, neighbor. Howdy, neighbor.
Shout it out, guys.
Toy Story.
Yeah. Sid. Yeah.
Okay, this one is a little bit of a stretch because it's a historical detail, but next door or all around is the Thunderbolt roller coaster on Coney Island.
Oh, howdy, neighbor. Annie Hall.
That is right.
Oh, yes. Wow.
We had some internal debate. Allison, I think I agree with your wow, but whether or not this would be a memorable detail of this movie, because I was trying to solicit some ideas from my fellow Max Fun team, and that was one of the ones
that I got. Your co-owners?
Yeah. Actually, we can thank super producer Laura Swisher for that one.
Oh,
Swish.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Swish.
Next door is a noisy fraternity house that's keeping your new baby up at night.
Oh,
howdy, neighbor.
Howdy,
neighbors.
Yes.
It's right there.
And if it were a noisy sorority?
Neighbors too.
Yes, neighbors too. Sorority rising. All right, I have just two more. Next door is a very appealing lighthouse.
Howdy, neighbor.
Yes.
Is it the lighthouse?
It's the lighthouse. Yes.
Okay, I was like, Annihilation? What are we talking about?
Ooh,
the light between oceans?
all fair game. And finally, next door is your student, who is really too old to still be in high school, but that's no excuse, Jennifer Lopez.
Oh, the boy next door. Oh, howdy, neighbor.
All right.
That's too exciting.
Great. Good job. Points all around. I love it.
A 29-year-old high school student. Yeah.
Well, we did it, you guys. First quiz of the new year.
Solid quiz, Marissa.
Thank you very much. And if that was any indication, I think we're off to a great start with quizzes in 2024.
Hurrah.
So. All right.
Your boy is back.
Back.
You let us off.
Yeah. Back. This was true at some point. But yeah, now it's time for staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
I will. I would love to. And you know why? It is a film that has long been a favorite of mine. I did not get to discuss it on this here podcast, and it was produced by our guest, Allison Dickey, and that is The Sisters Brothers, a movie that I love, and honestly only tied in recently that it was Allison's baby. It's fantastic. It stars every actor you've ever enjoyed. John C. Reilly, Joaquin Phoenix, Jake Gyllenhaal, Riz Ahmed. Rutger Hauer is in this thing. I loved it so much. I talked about it in detail when I did a Modern Westerns podcast on Screen Drafts.
Oh, right.
If you haven't seen it, it is currently available for free with ads on like Freevee, Pluto, Tubi, one of Alonzo's stations. It's also available for rent. You could purchase it and treasure it forever. But yeah, man, it's set in the 1800s. It has gold prospectors. It has headhunters. It has assassins. It's got everything. It's so good. It's got it right. It has chemical spill. What doesn't it have? But it's so thoughtful. And so I was like, oh, if you don't understand men, do I have the movie for you? So yeah.
And if you think you don't like Westerns, it is a movie for you, because yes. that is not necessarily like my go-to genre, but I love this movie too.
Yeah.
Mine is not nearly so classy, but I just thought it's very exciting that, I don't know how it took this long, but we finally have a 4K with extras of 1985's flop-turned-cult favorite, Clue. Shout Selects finally in December put out the very first ever 4K release of the film. Now, the second disc is a Blu-ray, so if you don't have a 4K system, which I still don't, you can still enjoy it, and that's where all the extras live. There's an interview with Jonathan Lynn, the writer-director. They talk to the producer. They talk to the composer is no longer with us, but I think one of his kids does a featurette as well. So if you are obsessed with Clue, this is the home video release you've been waiting for. And if you're obsessed with Clue and have a 4K system, then this is going to be hotter than the flames on the side of my face.
Flames on the side of my face, burning. Oh, it's the best movie.
Great.
Allison.
Hey, you guys, thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate it.
Number one fan.
I love that movie. But I want to, so I'm going to do for my staff pick, because I was thinking about sound design. And, you know, when you are, when you're a producer, it's like producers care about sound because, God, we're super forgiving with shitty, you can have like a really crappy, you know, Super 16 black and white image. But if your sound isn't good, the audience is out. You know, how many screenings have we been at Sundance or wherever, where we're just like, oh, you know, it's so important. So, you know, that's just good sound, but then good sound design really elevates a film. And it's one of the most incredible things I think that some directors really have in their quiver. And I, you know, we talked about it a lot with the Zone of Interest, but that is one of the things that attracted me to Jacques Audiard initially, was his sound design, first with Read My Lips. But I was just thinking of the movie The Beat That My Heart Skipped, and that had just incredible sound design, and it, you know, wove music in, and it's a tough, cool movie. And you know, now you gotta go dig around and find it, but that would be my pick.
Nice.
And it's nice to think about directors that really care about, you know, the design of sound as an incredible artistic element of their work. So anyway, there you go.
Solid nerdy good pick
one. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Iffy, what you got?
Well, I'm gonna go you know, I kind of you know, teased it, so I'm going to go ahead and finish it with Walter Hill's The Driver, which, you know, in 1978 came out on January 1st, a great movie to start the year with, and, you know, and adapted from Le Samurai, which is something I've picked before and had a very heated rebuff when everyone was so shocked I didn't see Maltese Falcon. Chelsea Krister, friend of the pod, and M were like, you have a movie pass and you didn't see Maltese Falcon. And I was like, well, I saw Le Samurai, which arguably paved the way for Maltese Falcon. And then it was a whole thing, and the video store clerks were just kind of like looking at us, and it was like, what is this?
They're going to pull your card.
Yeah. And I'm like, so yes. Yeah. So we'll watch that. Get some of that noir, some of that gang, that crime in your life.
So, excellent choice.
Yes. Thank you so much, Allison Dickey. Is there anything you want to plug for the listeners?
Thank you, guys. So fun.
Do you have a social media presence? Do you have anything you want to promote?
No, not really. Not right now, but I'll let y'all know.
God, I envy you.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll make that a what's good. So that's all good. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, listener. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Iron Claw, and our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart, who I inadvertently created a new movie nickname, Flaxbart. Nice. And also, thank you for popping on and, you know, quizzing us, and that was the first quiz I think I did the best in. And shout out to our senior producer, Laura Swisher. And this is still a production of Maximum Fun. Happy 2024.
Yay! Yay.
Maximum Fun, a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.